and happy holidays. You're listening to The Chat, conversations with alumni from the University of Technology Sydney. I'm Nina Copel. If you've been to the Australian Museum recently, you would have been met with an array of eight-legged friends and foes in a spider exhibit that would give arachnophobes nightmares for the rest of their life. But the reason I found myself at the museum was to meet Kim McKay, the museum's first female director and CEO, but also an all-round cool person. She co-founded and grew Clean Up Australia to be what it is today, and travelled around the world working for National Geographic. But to talk about her current role in her current job, I talked with Kim in the craft room of the museum, which she set up to honour the controversial curator and secretary of the museum from 1861 to 1874.
So Gerard Krefft was the 7th curator-director of the Australian Museum. I'm the 17th. And he was from Germany. He came to Australia in the 1850s with the gold rush. So he'd gone to America to try and discover his fortune there. He was an amateur zoologist. He failed in the States, but read about the fact there was this gold rush starting to happen in Australia. And again, didn't succeed at finding gold, but he did get the job as assistant curator at the then new Melbourne Museum. And a year later, he came to Sydney. I say he saw the light and moved north. And he came to the Australian Museum as an assistant curator. And the director died in office and he took over as the chief curator and director of the museum. Now, he was very controversial. He was here for about 14 years in the role. And his tenure was controversial because he'd become very good friends with Charles Darwin via correspondence. Krefft was responsible for discovering something like 30 Australian species, from the saltwater crocodile to the cassowary, the lungfish. He was the expert on snakes in Australia. And so he and Darwin were constantly writing to each other, and here on the walls of the Krefft Room, you'll see examples of some of that correspondence between them. Well, of course, the trust of the museum, who would have sat around this beautiful cedar table we're seated at now on these very special chairs that I've had restored. There are 12 chairs around this table, 11 for the trustees, and there still are only 11 trustees of the museum, and the 12th seat being for the director or the curator. So Krefft fought with them because they were all confirmed creationists. And you'll notice through the window, what do you see when you look out the window of the Krefft Room? You see St Mary's Cathedral directly opposite. So I see the Australian Museum position here as this tussle at the time between creationism and evolutionary theory. And so the trustees didn't like that, and Krefft was an obstinate person. There was a quote from the Evening News in Sydney in 1881 that's on the wall here, which said if he had been as much at home with men as with animals, or could have charmed his trustees as cleverly as he did his snakes, his fate would have been a much fairer one. So dear Gerard Krefft, who worked so hard to promote science, he was the one who introduced the study of science to the Australian Museum, and we are the second oldest scientific institution in the country. So Krefft fought with them. One night he was sitting in this very room, reading a book, in that chair in the corner, and we have a lovely brown comfy chair from the mid-1800s. And he barricaded himself in the museum. He wouldn't leave his beloved museum. Two prize fighters from the local bazaar, and in those days Hyde Park was a racetrack, and it had all sorts of nefarious characters hanging around it. We're in the back of Darlinghurst here, so it was quite a well-known zone for brothels and other activities late at night. And this racetrack in the middle of the city, now Hyde Park, it had a carnival there, a bazaar, and there was a prize fighting ring. So the trust hired two of these burly blokes who came over to the museum, broke down the door, came in, found Krefft sitting in that very chair, picked up the chair and him in it and carried him out and put him on William Street. And he was never allowed back in the museum. His wife and kids were away. He had two sons that night, so they didn't see it. But a friend of his was here with him. I guess they were sitting, smoking cigars, drinking scotch or whatever single blokes did in those days on when their wives were away. And it was sort of the end of an era.
You obviously value his legacy, but do you think that any of his rebellion is something that you have kind of taken on and hold in you as well in your role as director?
When I hung the portrait of Gerard Krefft over the mantelpiece there, I said, okay, Jerry, you've got to look after me while I'm in this job. Being the 17th director, I'm the first woman to run the Australian Museum. So I needed a bit of extra pluck, I think, when I started out here. And I also, what I liked about Kreft is he did introduce the study of science here, and he stood up and fought for science when it was under attack by the creationists. Now, science has been under attack again through issues like climate change, and I have been a long environmental campaigner in terms of raising awareness of environmental issues, and I'm very committed to continue to do that here at the Australian Museum. So I think I need a little bit of Kreftonian magic at different times to stand up and advocate, not in an aggressive way, but certainly in a scientifically factual way. Because here at the museum, apart from what the public see on the floor, we've got this magnificent research institute. So the Australian Museum Research Institute has over 100 scientists working day in, day out on very applied science, and climate change is wrapped up in that. We look at biosecurity in Australia, the biodiversity of our endemic species. We look at a whole raft of things like we have one of the most advanced DNA labs in the country, where our work on wildlife genomics is renowned. Dr. Rebecca Johnson, who runs the Australian Museum Research Institute, sequenced the DNA of the koala for the first time, and now she's heading up a consortium across Australia working on sequencing the DNA of all the Australian mammals. We also do the work for the airline industry on bird strike on aircraft. So don't worry if you're about to fly somewhere, but let me tell you, there are on average about 4 birds strike on aircraft a day in Australia. There's not much left of the poor bird once they've been chewed up by a propeller. So we literally have a forensics kit. Our team will go out, or we'll send it to the airport, and we swab the propellers for the blood of the bird, and then we identify what species it was. And we work with the airport then to either relocate the flock or work out why they're nesting nearby. And it's a really important role, not just, of course, to preserve the bird species, but also for human safety. You wouldn't think a museum would be involved in that sort of applied science. We also do all the work for customs and quarantine. So when people try to smuggle illegal wildlife in or out of Australia and they're caught, the samples of that wildlife come to the Australian Museum for analysis. And it's amazing how people try and smuggle things into or out of Australia in their underpants usually. So I've seen all sorts of interesting pictures of bird eggs strapped in various positions. But our team here in our wildlife genomics lab also identify those particular species as well. So these are all very practical applied roles that museum science does now. And DNA has really become the tool for museums. Of course, in our collections here at the museum, we have more than 18 million different specimens and objects in the collection. So we can actually use DNA now to look at some of those specimens that have been in the collection for more than 150 years and really try and find out what's happened to that species through that DNA history we've collected. So museums, of course, right around the world are using this tool now, and it really helps inform what's happening to our biodiversity in Australia.
That's so interesting. And I want to ask you more about the work that's happening here and the research that's happening here and your role in driving that. But before I do, I want to take you back a little bit to where things began. And I'm just kind of thinking, looking at your life and the journey you've taken from sort of growing up in the Northern Beaches, and then the start you kind of got with project management with the Around the World yacht races, and then Clean Up Australia. What's with water? Is that something that means a lot to you?
It sure is. Well, growing up the Northern Beaches, so I was born in the Manly area and grew up there until I was about 5, and we moved to England for my dad's job. And certainly the memories of growing up there are about going to the beach. They were sitting on the beach getting hugely burned. I think my parents used to rub olive oil and brown vinegar into my skin, so I was sort of like a salad basking in the sun, and going brown as a berry, popping into the ocean with my dad. You know, it when you grow up around the Northern Beaches or the Southern Beaches in Sydney, it does get into your blood, I think, and I'm happiest when I'm near the ocean. I like sailing. I'm very fortunate now that I live in a small apartment in Sydney where I get to look out at the harbour. And I just love that smell of salt water. It does flow in my veins.
Tell me where the Clean Up Australia was born. Also on the water, I believe.
It was. I was working on the BOC Challenge, the Solo Around the World Yacht Race, as a project manager from 1982. Golly, I nearly said 1892. I must say I feel that old today, but I'm not really. So going back to 1982... But it was after the 86-87 race when Ian Kiernan sailed a boat called Spirit of Sydney in the race, and all of the competitors in the race kept their plastic rubbish on board, and it was staggering to see how much plastic waste one person could generate over a period of being alone at sea for 6 weeks. And in each port we'd weigh and measure it. There were a group of thousands of American school kids following the race as a school project. And I think for everyone involved, the lights started going off for us. You know, you didn't think about it much before that. But, my God, look at how much waste one person produces. And historically, any boat at sea used to dump its waste overboard. Nobody. The cruise ships weren't keeping on board. The single biggest offender in those days was the US Navy. It was dumping thousands of tons of waste overboard every day. Well, as we know, plastic doesn't really diminish in the world's oceans. It's just increasing those amazing gyres in the North Pacific. And, the competitors started to see it in the oceans as well. And when Ian sailed through the Sargasso Sea in the mid-Atlantic, the golden seaweed there was choked with plastic of all sorts of descriptions. So after the race was over, he walked into my office one day and said, you know, Kim, years ago I saw a clean-up in Hawaii. Do you think we could do that here? He was very worried about Sydney Harbour. And I said, yes, we can do that. Let's do it. And I swung around to this is pre-computer days. I had an IBM golf ball typewriter, and we wrote the first letter on the clean-up file to the then Minister for Ports in New South Wales, Laurie Brereton, saying, you know, years ago, you launched my boat, my campaign, I'd like to clean up Sydney Harbour, would you support us? And of course, it took about 8 weeks to get a response, and it was obviously written by the department saying, dear Mr. Kiernan, thank you, no, but my department looks after the cleaning of Sydney Harbour. And I think it was a good lesson for us all, because there were a group of friends who got together to coordinate this. You know, if you get no as an answer and you really want to do something, you shouldn't let that stop you. It spurred us all on, and of course, we went on the 8th of January 1989 and organised the first clean-up of Sydney Harbour, and 40,000 people turned out. You know, that's more you get to most football matches in Sydney. And it was an amazing day, because people of all ages, all cultures, they came from the Blue Mountains. They weren't people who lived around the harbour, but they came down to make a statement that Sydney Harbour was the jewel in the crown of our city and it needed cleaning up. And we pulled 5,000 tons of rubbish and building waste and dumped car bodies, you name it, out of Sydney Harbour that day. And that, we say, is the day Sydney Harbour turned the corner. And it led not just to awareness about rubbish, but it led to all sorts of legislation and changes in the way councils and the state government were dumping overflows of sewage waste into the harbour and on the beaches. So it changed a lot of things. You get enough people out and taking action, it sends very clear messages that enough is enough.
Yeah, so I mean, for me, the Clean Up Australia Day thing, it was a cultural experience. Like, I went to primary school and we had a day where, you know, it would go around picking up rubbish. It did have a cultural legacy, and you had a cultural legacy through that organisation that you helped to set up. So what made you want to leave it? What made you move on to the next thing? When did you decide you were ready?
I think my whole life has always gone in sort of 9 to 10 year cycles. About every 10 years I shake things up and change them. And I'm a great believer that you should go out ahead on top and not sort of sit around for a long time. And also, movements, organisations need refreshing and they need leadership changes. And I think part of being a good leader is to say, you know what, I think I've made my contribution, I'm going to go and do something else now. And I was very fortunate, because I'd been working with the Discovery Channel, who'd recently launched in Australia, and they were doing an event in North Queensland called the Discovery Channel Eco Challenge, the adventure sports race. Because I'd had a bit of involvement in sport, And they realised that. They said, oh, would you come and project manage this? And I had a ball with it. And then the president of Discovery offered me a job working for him in the United States to project manage the event in both Morocco for a year and then Patagonia for a year. So I went, sure, shake it up. I've never been afraid of change and taking risks. I think, you know, you take calculated risks in things you do. And, you know, I was lucky. I thought, well, I'll go for 2 years. If it doesn't work out, that's fine. I can come back. But I moved then after 2 years working with Discovery Channel and having an amazing time working on Eco Challenge to the National Geographic Channel in Washington, who'd been launching around the world, and really just was so fortunate. I got the job of running marketing and communications globally, and it was a wonderful place. I really felt I was home. It was full of really smart people who were committed to explaining the world we lived in, and I got to travel extensively. I've always done that through my work, so it was wonderful. I spent a lot of time in Egypt, a lot of time in Peru, a lot of time in India, and really, apart from, you know, just about everywhere else in the world, and really, really loved what National Geographic stood for and still does stand for. And it was a great experience of really working in television and helping communicate science and the natural world to audiences around the world and adapt those messages. So, you know, no wonder I sort of ended up at the museum, I guess, because that Nat Geo experience really did help set me up for this.
When did you realise that communications was the way for you to explore these ideas and do things like exploring the pyramids of Egypt and translate that science? Did you go into communications knowing that was possible, or is it just your kind of innate interest in these things that came out?
Oh, look, I think there's always lots of different reasons. Certainly, I do believe I've got a bit of the PR gene. If there's DNA to be found in that, I probably have it, because I was like this at school, you know, I edited the school magazine and organised events there and just always got behind things. You know, I was on the Manly Junior Council. I was one of those irritating kids at school who'd volunteer for everything and get involved in everything. But I've always known that good communication can change things. If you explain things to people and explain the reasons behind it and the outcomes, you can solve most problems with people. You know, you've got to, communication is not a one-way thing, it's a two-way thing. And of course now with digital media, the realm has opened up dramatically about the importance of communication. You know, when I did the Institute of Company Directors board course, I sort of had a bit of a laugh that they've got on the agenda the impact of social media. Well, I just call it the impact of media. Most people are quite afraid of the media, and I've never been afraid of it. I've always understood it and studied it and worked collaboratively with media. And I think social media is great because it puts a lot of power in the public's hands. But we're seeing now, I think, some of the pitfalls of it. That, you know, how do you know what you're reading is true? We've seen that impact through the US election, and now European politicians are concerned about it with their elections coming up. You know, and my niece is 25 and she has studied communications as well, and I was having this discussion with her the other day. I said, oh, did you see the article in the paper about the Australian Museum the other day? She said, no, Auntie Kim, I don't read the paper. And I said, well, where are you getting your news? She said, on Facebook. And I'm devastated by that because it's not a news source. It's, you know, at best, informally curated information. And you have to be very careful about how you are being informed. And every young person has to start understanding that a 10-second read of something on a Facebook post or an Instagram post or whatever it might be is not sufficient to develop an informed opinion. So I think we've got a lot of work to do right now to encourage people to really question the information they're receiving and to look for more information behind the headline, because really all we're getting is headlines, you know, grabs, 5-second grabs here and there. So I'm very interested in what's going to happen in the future, but certainly for from the museum's point of view, the Australian Museum is 190 years old next year, which is just extraordinary. And it gives us a platform to be our own media organisation now. Once we would have had to rely on the commercial media outlets or the ABC to get our story out there or 2SER-FM. But now, of course, we can be our own voice through social media, through digital media. You know, with 18 million objects in the collection, I've got 18 million stories to tell. So I think museums around the world are going to be significant content creators in the future. And telling those stories is what I love.
Do you think that's what makes you necessary for the Australian Museum at this time, as a sort of social scientist as opposed to a hard scientist like all the people who've come before you? Is that the appeal of your skills and the and your strengths that is necessary in this complex sort of media environment?
Well, I'd like to say so. Other people might disagree with that fervently. But, yeah, look, being a social scientist is the worst kind of scientist of all, you know, according to the pure scientists. But it is a skill set that is needed in this day and age, I think certainly in this transitionary period as well. And it doesn't diminish the role of pure science either. I've appointed Dr. Rebecca Johnson, who is a population... She is a wildlife geneticist who's been at the museum now 13 years to head up our research institute, and she does that brilliantly. But certainly in this day and age, it's like running a small business, well, medium-sized business. I have 300 staff here and a big budget. And I have to generate a lot of that money. The museum has to generate its own funds. So as well as designing appealing programs that the public want to be part of and running great education projects, you've also got to be thinking about how do you fund the organisation and make it sustainable into the future. So skills in communications, skills in business management, skills in fundraising, skills in production and understanding both media production and exhibition production are incredibly important, but also primarily a real curiosity and love of science and the natural world. And I've always felt that I had that ability to translate science for people. So I worked on a project in the United States for National Geographic called the Genographic Project with Dr. Spencer Wells, who's a population geneticist. And I was working with him on a film called The Journey of Man, which basically said that, you know, he was one of the first population geneticists to identify that humans left Africa about 60,000 years ago and walked the southern coastal migratory route to Australia over a 10,000-year period. So this project looks at deep ancestry. And as I was starting to understand a little bit about this, my job was to say to people, watch this film because this is what it will reveal for you. It was quite complex science. But the more I got into it, the more I saw the potential for it. And working with Spencer, who was a great scientist, but marrying that with the skills I had, the marketing and communication skills, meant that we could actually create something that was much more impactful. And so we co-developed the Genographic Project and we got support from IBM and set up about 14 principal investigators in science institutes around the world. And we've had well over 1 million people purchase the Genographic kit. And that's helped our understanding of human history, of where we came from and how we got here. And it's marrying those skills. So no one has... You know, I'm a great believer you can never do anything alone. You have to do it in teams, and it's putting the right team together, the right skill sets. And it's just at this particular point in history. I mean, we've seen recently the new director of the Melbourne Museum is a woman, Lindley Marshall, and she's out of the ABC, has a media background as well. And we've seen other appointments. Daryl Karp, who runs the Museum of Australian Democracy, is also out of ABC Documentaries. So we're seeing a shift, certainly, in the appointments of the director because it is that particular time in history where I think an understanding of digital media is incredibly important.
There's also research, I think, that says that most museums have more people accessing their website than walking through the door. So is that something that's a threat to you, or is that a... Is that potential for more people to access your stories?
Certainly not a threat. I love it. The more and more people who can access... In fact, half of our traffic to our website comes through photographs, people searching photographs of animals, and then they end up at our site. But, you know, people still want to see the real thing. I was with a group of kids the other day. They were 9 and 10-year-olds from Western Sydney. They came into the museum to do a school project with us on the museum of the future, what they wanted to see here in the future. So they ran around with their sheets and looked at everything on the floor and came back, and I asked them, okay, so tell me, what is it you want to see? And all these hands shot up in the air, these really enthusiastic faces. That's what I love most about being on the floor here, of looking at the little faces, you know, be awed by what they're looking at, and that curiosity sparked. Anyway, I started talking to them, saying, what do you want to see? Well, they wanted to see more spiders, more snakes, more sharks, more crocodiles, more insects. And on it went. And it was about the 50th kid who said he wanted to see more digital. And I put that down to museums will always have this significant role to play of showing people the real thing. And, you know, kids today are growing up with that phone, that digital device in the palm of their hand already. It's normal to them. It's not, oh, a digital project that works alongside everything else. It's just normal. And they can get that any time, day or night. They can look up anything. They can see anything. But to actually come into an institution that's been around for a long time and see the real thing and then marry the communication, the digital communication with what they're looking at, can take you to all sorts of new places. And they can take that discovery home with them then, which is pretty exciting. So, in fact, in our new plans for the museum in the future, we've put in that we'd like to have a digital orientation room. So you buy a ticket and you come into the museum and you go into this area and you select the way in which you want to experience the museum. And you can program that in advance, or you can just walk in, you know, if you choose to. But if you want to take advantage of all these wonderful technologies in the future, you know, we were the first museum in Australia to bring David Attenborough's virtual reality experience. He made 2 virtual reality films, one on the Great Barrier Reef. And they were just extraordinary. They brought 100,000 new visitors to the museum who hadn't been here before. Quite something. So people are really fascinated by the new technologies and ways of experiencing them. And, you know, you look at virtual reality and how it can help you understand things better. We've got a new virtual reality program about in Aboriginal First Contact called Collisions that we'll be showing in January. And that program just puts you in the middle of the outback. And you sit on a swivel seat and you spin around and you're right there. It's quite extraordinary. So that's just one thing. So the new technologies haven't been invented yet. I mean, we're going to be doing some HoloLens experiences here in the coming year. So, golly, I'm so excited by what it's going to reveal.
I normally sort of wind these to an end by asking people what their hopes are for the future or where they hope their careers will take you, but you seem so invested in the future of this place. Is there anything else, though, that you're kind of burning to explore or feel like you haven't done yet that you really want to?
1,000 things. And I will keep working, I think, to the day I keel over. For the foreseeable future, I'd like to stay here at the Australian Museum if they'll have me, because I really am passionate about it. I'm passionate about education, passionate about inspiring, inquiring minds, really passionate about Australian history and helping facilitate the telling of those stories by our Indigenous people and people of the Pacific as well. You know, we say we're the Museum of Australia and the Pacific because it's on our doorstep, yet few of us really understand Pacific cultures, and our collection's the finest in the world. So being able to help facilitate that along with the science is really important. In the short term, I'm just looking forward to a little bit of a lie down over the holidays and to read some books. You know, I get home at night and often I'm at events here at night. I'm so tired, I don't have time to have that relaxing read. So I'm planning to do a lot more reading in the coming months, have a bit more rest, and then come back refreshed and raring to go because there's so much to do here.
And that's it for the chat today. If you like the show, please click the subscribe button so you don't miss a moment. You can also catch up on season 1. If you want to know more about the program, head to our website, 2ser.com/thechat. This show is produced with the support of the University of Technology Sydney and 2SER. I'm Nina Copel. Thanks for your company.